And in Koinonia Fireside Room this afternoon is Lisa Kildegard, the session O Taste and See, Contemporary Poetry. Today's session is called Then the Angel Showed Me the River of the Water of Life. Let's listen in.
Those of you who are back for more poetry, and thank you for those of you who are coming around the first time. It's good to see all of you. What we do in this totally fabulous session is we read poems and we talk about them. That's about as high tech as we get. We talk about what we see there, we talk about what on earth a poet might mean, and we kind of go from there. I am taking as my rubric for this week and next the words from the wonderful passage from Revelation on the Tree of Life that several of you have already heard during this week because we are focusing on it. And today's poems are centered around two parts of this passage. The first, Then the Angel Showed Me. And the second is the river. The river of the waters of life, or something like this. The river. As it happens, it is not difficult at all to find poems about angels and rivers. These are powerful images, metaphors, ideas, what have you, that the human imagination, I think, is drawn to. And I think probably everyone in this room has had some experience of standing by a river and reflecting and watching the river go by. Maybe some of you have even had some experience with angels. Maybe we could talk about that too. As a matter of fact, in recent years, there's been a kind of resurgence of interest in heavenly harbingers of the divine. There's a lot of calendars now with angels on them. You can buy little angel pins at Walmart. People seem to be, Walmart selling angels. No, there's a, that's the kind of, I don't know what's next. Maybe community organizing pamphlets pick them out of Walmart, that would be, if they can turn a profit. People talk a lot about their guardian angels. It seems to be something that people are interested in. In my admittedly limited experience reading the Bible, angels in the Bible don't really seem to look that much like those little Renaissance cherubs with the wings. It seems to me that when people see angels in the Bible, what do they often do?
They're messengers.
They're messengers. And how do people respond? They're terribly afraid. They do anything to get away. They fall on their knees. They cover their heads. It's can be a pretty terrifying experience. We have some less threatening angels in our poems today, and we have some poems about the river. One of the things I have found in looking for these poems is that the river is a very mutable type of image. It can stand for many things. It always seems to have something to do with time and the passage of time. That's what Heraclitus thinks when he examines the river and sees that you can't step into the same place twice. But there's a lot of room in these two sort of congregations of ideas there's a lot of room for a lot of different varieties. I think we'll start with the angels. And my idea in reading poetry is it's got, it's for you. There shouldn't be anything too mysterious. If it's mysterious, we'll work on it. We'll try to get to some understanding and knowledge of it, but we also must remember that there's an ethics of pleasure. I'm kind of into the content as opposed to the enjoyment sort of by instinct. So we have to remember to enjoy ourselves also. We can talk about that too. And all poetry, we talked a little bit about this yesterday. Was that just yesterday? All poetry can shift you out of your rut and put you in some kind of new place of vision. That's the really remarkable function, I think, of poetry. Let's start with this poem called Zero Gravity by a contemporary poet named McKeel McBride. I found out preparing for this session that this is a woman's name, McKeel McBride. I don't know, maybe I should have held that back. But she is a professor out of the East Coast, one of those, I don't know, New Hampshire or Vermont or one of those eastern states. Mm-hmm. And writes a lot of poetry. I only know two of her poems, and I like them both very much. I've got both of them along, and I hope to get to know more of her. This is a poem that was printed in The Nation. Zero Gravity. The storm gets in my phone, and when I lift the receiver, I can hear a polar bear scratching the sky open to make more snow. But then the repairman arrives in a red shirt and climbs the pole, and it looks just like the right-sized rose has bloomed on the wooden stem. He gets all the bad weather out of the phone, and it doesn't take him long either. Comes into my kitchen very quiet to computer check the line. Just what you'd expect from someone who goes to the place where all the words have stopped and installs there a river that can disobey the strongest dam. Even indoors, the repairman swims in wind. In all of this, a bright bouquet of wires in his hand. You'd have to hold a lot of silence in you to do this job right. As he's finishing up, he asks about the aquarium near the phone, then says softly, I like them so much. The fish, that in summer I go out to the deepest part of the river. That's where they are. And I am simply with them. You don't see many, but you know they're there. That's what matters. I call it zero gravity. Then he looks up, remembering he's not talking to himself, surprised to have given away the secret of deep summer solace in the course of a regular repair. But it's one and the same thing. Fish touched by all parts of their world, by all parts of their world at once. A belonging, an endless, wordless singing. The repairman moving on to the next broken thing. But not without leaving my phone full of roses and catfish, trout and clouds. And I figure if it were to happen, this is the way an angel would appear. In work boots, in a red flannel shirt, in a truck heavy with the ordinary tools of the world, hard hat and sky-friendly ladder. A real rose surviving in the middle of 100 blizzards. A man who understands the holy language of the fish. Those beings who neither hold nor let go, but simply allow the light current of the living water to carry them. Yes, as both rivers and angels. All right, now we're going to do two things with this poem at least, and many more that I don't know yet. And the first thing is to try and write the poem in a sentence again. So take the poem and say, in a narrative sentence, in this poem, a woman does what, or a man comes, and so think for a minute, turn to your neighbor, and give them your sentence of this poem. Okay, now we're going to do some harder work, which is we're going to take it stanza by stanza and say, what's important in the stanza? What's an image that strikes you from a stanza that seems to be sort of central to where that poem is, where it is? And I'll just divide the group in half, and we'll just start with this side. You've got the big team, so I know you'll be really good. Just you work on stanza one, and you over here just work on stanza two, and we'll just go stanza by stanza through it and see, what do you notice? What strikes you? What seems poetic? As she tells this very common story, right? Phone's broken, guy fix it, she's grateful. Very normal story. What does she what is she really doing poetically to pay attention to this? So this group, stanza one, what sticks out? Stanza two.
I know that...
Okay, let's just wait, talk amongst yourselves a little bit, and then we'll come as a larger group. Thanks, sorry, I didn't tell you that. Not as a whole group, but just amongst each other. Okay, group number one, that was all the time you get. What kind of images are there that are striking you? Group number two, you're next.
All right, all the rivers.
Polar bears scratching to make more snow.
Yeah, that's pretty poetic. It seems like the perfect thing to say, though, doesn't it?
Yeah.
Polar bears scratching.
But she sets up all these images in white.
Yeah.
The polar bear, the snowstorm, and then she just has this rose blooming up.
Yeah, oh, that's good. You know, I hadn't really thought of that. The color, I'm not a very visual person. The color of the white storm and the white, do you feel like it's winter?
More snow.
Yeah, more snow, and then you've got the red rose. Okay, so the repairman is a rose. Why is he a rose?
Red shirt.
Because he's wearing a red shirt. Any other reason for him?
He also has a bright bouquet of wires in his hand.
And he's also associated with the bouquet of wires. That's coming up.
And he's on a wooden stem.
And he's on a wooden stem, the pole. So he's turning the barren snowscape into a place where a rose is blooming. Good. This side, what's in stanza two? Any image or?
Well, the weather image continues.
Mm-hmm.
Bad weather, the river, the dam. I mean, you get the natural forces carried on.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, here comes the river in this stanza. And what is the river doing in this stanza? Where is the river?
It's
in the line.
It's in the line.
So he's turning her bad phone from being a bad weather phone into a phone that has a river and the thing that would interrupt the flow of words, it changes from the polar bear in the storm to a dam holding back the river. See how easily she's shifted from sort of one metaphoric system to another? It's not fighting a storm anymore, it's fighting the dam. The river is fighting more powerful than the dam. Okay, and in this sort of, yeah.
It's kind of interesting too, it seems like when she talks about him, his being very quiet is important because yeah. that's the only way she describes him,
yeah.
And then just what you would expect
yeah.
from someone. So he's very quiet.
Yes, so he doesn't bring back the river of words by being a river of words himself. I think that's really important. He's silent and yet he restores the river of words.
Mm.
All right, let's go. This is good. Let's go to the next two stanzas. You'll be on stanza three and stanza four over here. Okay, verse number three. What's happening in that verse? We like the bouquet. Okay, I'm always asking my students in class, a bouquet of flowers, good thing or bad thing? That's good, right? That's good.
Bright.
A rose, always good, even when it has thorns, right? Right. A dark, stormy night, more dangerous. It's just sort of the building blocks of our metaphoric structures. So he's holding a bright bouquet of wires in his hands. What else about him?
He swims in the wind, which...
Mm-hmm. He swims in wind.
Then the fish thing doesn't seem so far-fetched.
That's exactly right. She's sort of, I don't know, you know, have you ever seen those? I guess it's kind of like a slinky. She's putting her metaphor down there, and then the next end comes, and then it comes further a little bit along. So she's had him out in the wind, and then she's had the river, and now he's swimming in the wind, and pretty soon he's going to be in the river. Right, swims in wind, good thing or bad thing?
Either.
Good. Could be either.
Yeah.
Yeah. I think it's good too.
Here it's okay.
Here it's okay. Also, holding a bright bouquet, but he also holds a lot of silence.
Yeah, he holds a bright bouquet and silence. How do those things balance against each other? Or do they? Are they part of the same Characteristic?
Again, it's the slinky, because the previous, she talked about him being very quiet.
Yeah.
And then he comes.
Yeah.
But she's picking up the rose.
Yep.
The rose, he is the rose. Okay.
And he holds the flowers.
And also the dam before.
Yeah. Yeah.
Held the noise.
Mm-hmm.
And he holds the silence, so it's...
Oh, that's good. Yeah.
And then he says softly the last line at the very end.
Softly.
Silence and software.
Well, what about the one in the second verse where someone who goes to the place where all the words have stopped, that kind of relates to the holding the silence?
Yeah. Okay, it's kind of neat that they're holding. It's kind of neat that he's holding this bright bouquet, which, you know, I almost think of as chatty.
Yeah.
You know, like an offering.
Yeah.
Of communication in a very silent person.
Yeah. Why would a silent person be the one who can go to where all the words have stopped? Why is that? It makes sense.
Hmm? He'd be at home there.
Yeah.
It wouldn't be scary.
He's a listener.
He's a listener. Yeah.
And it takes us just to go where there's no language.
Yeah, maybe. It's good. Well, no, what's the meaning to notice about the next verse?
It's in italics.
It's in italics, so that kind of sets it apart. Do you see where it's located in the poem? The exact center. So here we hear his voice in the exact center. And it is kind of a hinge between what happens before and what happens after. So what did you hear in his voice when he does speak softly?
Oh, the centering there, because he calls it zero gravity, the place where the person gives us the poem its title. So
that's right.
It's got to be important.
That's right. Good eye. Zero gravity. And what is zero gravity for him?
Just the fish swimming in the river, knowing there's something underneath.
The deepest part of the river.
Usually zero gravity is when we get up beyond the stratosphere.
Yep, that's right. So it shouldn't be deep, it should be space, right? Where you're high.
So he's setting space for angels.
What does he like to do with the fish? What do you learn about him?
He's not a fisher to be there.
Yep, he's not catching them.
Watching it go by the current, like the language goes by in the wires, and he stands there.
He says, you know they're there.
He knows they're there, but he doesn't have to see them. He just likes to be with them. Okay, now we've really got kind of a layered sense of this guy, this man who's a rose, who's silent but knows where the words are, and who likes to be with the fish. Okay, it's getting to be rather an interesting fellow. Let's go all together through the next three verses. Then he looks up, remembering he's not talking to himself, surprised to have given away the secret of deep summer solace in the course of a regular repair. Okay, that's kind of the end of her story at that point, right? Mm-hmm. She comments a little bit more on her story, but that's kind of the end of it. He after this, he's moving on. And now she begins to kind of reflect on what this story means. And the first thing she says is, but it's one and the same thing. Fish touched by all parts of their world at once. A belonging, an endless, worldless singing. The repairman moving on to the next broken thing. Okay, how are these things the same? Do you remember that Sesame Street song? You know, two of these things are not like each other. How are these things like each other? The fish, she says, are like the repairman moving on to the next broken thing.
Suspended there, you're kind of moving around, kind of aimlessly.
There they are, sort of hanging in the stream, right? The stream is moving rapidly, usually, if the fish are like they are in Iowa. And the fish just sort of adjust and adapt and are touched by the stream. And then she says, an endless wordless singing. What is the endless wordless singing, and what is it doing here?
The fish seem to be part of their world. Mm-hmm. I mean, not separate from their world. And to me, that was where it would be endless, a kind of an experience of infinity, to be that much a part of your environment. Mm-hmm. That'll come about that. But wordless, you know, fish don't speak.
That's right.
They don't make any noise.
And here we get back to the silence, don't we? He's got that kind of silence that's not absence of words, it's more of this wordless singing. This
that's
kind
what
of.
Some poets have said. That's what, if you listen really carefully on a very quiet night, you can hear the stars singing.
Yeah.
I mean, it's that's a poetic way of saying there's something going on up there.
Mm-hmm. They did used to think that the rotation of the heavens and the stars and their spheres caused the music of the spheres. And certainly Dante, when he's having his great vision of the rose of heaven, imagines the angels sort of circulating around in these wheels of singing. So it seems like a very heavenly kind of vision, doesn't it? The fish are kind of like angels. And the repairman moves on to the next broken thing, but not without leaving my phone full of roses and catfish, trout and clouds.
It's like the fish touched on all parts of their world. You know,
yeah.
Repairman's dog brought that tradition.
That's right. All parts of the world are coming back in through the phone. And here she has her conclusion. And I figure if it were to happen, this is the way an angel would appear. Okay, in what way? In work boots, in a red flannel shirt, in a truck heavy with the ordinary tools of the world, hard hat and a sky-friendly ladder.
To see the magical and mystical in the ordinary is a real spiritual exercise.
That's right. And here come the trout and the clouds into her phone again. You know, into her common everyday household object, telephone.
And she feels as though perhaps she's entertained an angel.
Yes, yeah, and she thinks an angel has come. A real rose surviving in the middle of 100 blizzards, a man who understands the holy language of the fish, those beings who neither hold nor let go, but simply allow the light current of the living water to carry them. Now I want to repeat for you a few of the images that she's been using. The rose, singing, the living water, the repairman, right? Where do we see these images used? Where? And fish, right, that's right. That's
no,
the fish.
Religious.
Yeah, this is Christian iconography, isn't it?
Yeah. Did the poet intend that?
I have no idea whatsoever. But we do have the rose, we've got the fish, we've got the living water, we've got powerful, powerful images that Christians, I would say Christians, also use to describe faith experiences, right? In which case, the repairman might be
Christ.
In his hard hat and flannel shirt.
And the sky-friendly ladder, that's all of a sudden a real interesting.
Well, living water.
And living water.
Now it takes out the dams and the connections.
That's right. Oh. That's right. And has a kind of silence, you know, and yet opens up the living word, the word to come through.
I'd like to add something from a short story I read once. The suddenly faced by a pair of angels, dressed in work boots and work shirts and so forth, and he stands there and he says, I thought angels spent all their time praising God. And one of them says, but what else is honest work?
Yeah, honest work. That's good. Now, for me, to think of him as a Christ figure deepens the poem without flattening it. You know, I don't think that we should then say, oh, look, it's Christ. Okay, here comes Jesus. All right, now I understand it. Jesus comes, fixes the phone.
Whoa.
To me, that would be a very reductive reading, right? We're just like flatten it right out.
But Lisa, you said at the beginning that
your car repairman was an angel.
Yeah.
I mean,
yeah.
You didn't say it that way, but I have worshipped those angels myself.
lovely guy. Yeah, so to me, it adds that extra sort of level of richness. And I also think that, you know, we're human beings with a long history of symbol making, and it comes up through poems. I don't know that McKeel McBride sat down and thought, okay, I've got these Christian symbols and I want to tell a story using them. I really doubt it. I think rather she used what's in our paint box, right? And that a lot of those are things that we share. It's a wonderful poem that way. Okay, Black Rook in Rainy Weather. Let's do a little short, easy one first. A Large White Rock Called the Sleeping Angel by Gregory Orr, who is also a current living poet, must be in his 40s, I think. This poem, I think, must be about 15 years old. He lay down in this field to rest, seeing an ant carry a white egg the size of a rice grain. The angel believed it was a sign the animals of this world wanted to make him their king. While he slept, sheep licked his salt wings. Only these stubs remained. Okay, now I just want you to close your eyes and think this poem silently in your head. Not using the exact words, just the best you can from what you remember. Okay, now what do you see in your mind's eye from this poem?
I had to come back to the title.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. That's very helpful.
More than one rock, probably.
I think there must be more than one rock. Should be two large white rocks. Or maybe, well, tell me what that rock looks like.
Or maybe it's one rock. Couple of bulges.
Mm-hmm. Couple of shoulder blades coming off the top. Okay, what does this poem mean? Why did he write it?
He saw a rock.
He saw a rock.
In that shape.
That's right. And he wanted to explain the name of it.
Do you think the rock could be a salt lake?
That's what I'm thinking.
Sure.
Ooh, the sheep of course. Rock salt create.
It's neat that seeing an ant carrying a white egg the size of a rice grain. I mean, when you think about the size of an ant, if it was carrying something the size of a rice grain, the ant is carrying something as large as itself. Mm-hmm. And he saw this as a sign that the world wanted to make him their king, which means which then to my thinking means then that he sees himself to be as large as the world,
mm-hmm.
that same size. And then for him to lay down and rest and have the sheep lick him down to a more manageable size is sort of interesting.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, there's a lot
to like a human size to do that reduction.
Yeah.
Which is what we all really do. We have to reduce it down to something that fits our minds. That's mm-hmm. why we don't get infinity.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah, the sheep lick the angel's wings down to stubs.
Yeah.
Okay, could the sheep be, as you say, lessons?
Because angelic wings are conceivable, really.
Yeah.
I mean, they're pretty pictures,
lick away at them.
Conceivable.
Sheep are drawn to his wings to lick, right? They're drawn to them like sheep are to a salt lick, and then they wear them down. Well, I have no idea why he liked this poem. I don't really know why I like it so much either. I just think it gives you a kind of interesting mental image. And there's probably something with the whiteness, right? The white egg, the rice grain, the white rock, the white sheep.
Although, if you really see sheep,
they are not in the right
mind. Also, our retired pastor used to tell us that sheep are very, very dumb. Very dumb. I wouldn't know, but that's what he said. Let's take a look at Black Rook. Now, move away from whiteness and into blackness. Black Rook in Rainy Weather by Sylvia Plath. And now, I just want you to forget, if you know, for a minute, that Sylvia Plath ended her life tragically at a young age by sticking her head in the oven. It's just a horrible, horrible story, and a sad one, and one that had, you know, long repercussions after her life was over. But try to read the poem as she wrote it, which was before she made that horrible decision, right? I have found that it's hard for people to read this poem and see anything, but look, this woman is going to stick her head in the oven, you know? And at this point, she wrote it not thinking, okay, maybe she did, but it's my theory that she might have written a lot of things before she decided to stick her head in the oven. So. And this is particularly important to me. Right now I'm working on the very last novel by Virginia Woolf, while it was still in proofs at the printer, loaded up her pockets with stones and walked into the river. And still I think, this doesn't always say she's about to walk into the river, so I'm trying to read it without that teleological, you know, or eschatological, or I get them mixed up, probably. But in ignorance of the conclusion.
Phenomenological.
Histology? Okay. Black Rook in Rainy Weather. On the stiff twig up there hunches a wet black rook, arranging and rearranging its feathers in the rain. I do not expect miracle or an accident to set the sight on fire in my eye, nor seek any more in the desultory weather some design, but let spotted leaves fall as they fall without ceremony or portent. Although I admit I desire occasionally some back talk from the mute sky, I can't honestly complain. A certain minor light may still leap incandescent out of kitchen table or chair, as if a celestial burning took possession of the most obtuse objects now and then, thus hallowing an interval otherwise inconsequent by bestowing largesse, honor, one might say, love. At any rate, I now walk wary. For it could happen, even in this dull, ruinous landscape. Skeptical, yet politic. Ignorant of whatever angel may choose to flare suddenly at my elbow. I only know that a rook, ordering its black feathers, can so shine as to seize my senses, haul my eyelids up, and grant a brief respite from fear of total neutrality. With luck, trekking stubborn through this season of fatigue, I shall patch together a content of sorts. Miracles occur, if you care to call those spasmodic tricks of radiance miracles. The wait's begun again, the long wait for the angel, for that rare, random descent. Okay, instead of trying to give the story here, because there really isn't much story in a sentence, try to state the poem's thesis. What argument is this poem making? What does she argue in a sentence with your neighbor? See if you can ferret that out. Okay, who's got the argument of the poem?
I don't know how it happens, but light comes out of darkness or something like that.
Light can come out of darkness, okay? Do we have darkness in this poem? Where do you see it? The rook is black.
And it's raining.
And it's raining.
Anything else that's dark?
Gray.
Sultry weather.
Sultry weather. Okay, what's bright? What's the light?
Cloud breaks.
Hmm?
Cloud breaks.
Cloud breaks.
Celestial burning.
Celestial burning, that's got to be pretty bright.
Light strikes the bird. You see the iridescent colors of it.
Yeah, that's right. A certain minor light. An angel may choose to flare. Okay, so we've got the forces of dark and the forces of light sort of aligned against each other in her poem. Anything else to add to that argument?
And once in a while the light breaks in,
mm-hmm,
and gives you enough to go on until it happens again.
That's right. Once in a while, how often would that once in a while be?
Never know. Maybe. Never in a whole season of fatigue.
That's right, a season of fatigue. Does that sound like a good thing, or? Oh no, that's bad, yeah. You might be a long, long wait.
It's rare and random.
Rare and random, what about those two words? What do you know about angels if you know they're rare and random?
You can't control them.
Yeah, way out of your control, that's right. And
what I would love to know is, why does she put the spaces between the lines where she does?
Yeah,
she's breaking right into the middle of a thought.
Yeah.
No punctuation. It's fascinating.
It is amazing, isn't it? And she's incredibly skillful at it. That's called enjambment, and it comes from the French word that I think means throwing your leg over. So you can see the poem throws its leg over into the next verse. And if you look at these verses, you can see that they, except for portent, I think that's the only one, they go right into the next verse, so you're kind of tumbled along. And as long as we're talking about versification, just listen to this. On the stiff twig up there hunches a wet black rook. What's the music of this poem, do you think? Choppy, that's excellent word for it. It's very choppy. Anything else?
Sounds one syllable words.
Lots of one syllable words. It doesn't have a beautiful lilting rhythm at all. You know, it doesn't have something, well, it's iambic, the iambic kind of voice that Shakespeare wrote. Shall I compare thee to a summer's day? Thou art far more lovely and more temperate. It just goes, it sort of sings along. Doesn't have that kind of rhythm to it at all. And I want you to notice something else.
Very iambic, very rough iambic meter to it if you take the two first lines and the third line. Two first lines is one iambic pentameter unit.
Read that for me so I can hear it.
On the stiff twig up there hunches a wet black rook.
Hunches a wet black rook.
Arranging and rearranging its feathers. Very rough.
Yep.
Very. It isn't going to be obtrusive. Make you fall into a sing song.
Mm-hmm. It is. Yep. Well, I still have trouble hearing it. But it must be that rough. I want you to notice something about the versification. How many lines does each verse have?
Five.
The center line. Now I want you to look at how that long center line ends in the word rain, design, complain, then, shine, season, again. Do you hear that? Sort of, it's not exactly a rhyme. Sometimes it rhymes, but it's definitely a repeated sound.
Look at the last word in each stanza.
Accident, portent, incandescent, inconsequent, ignorant, grant. Look at the second line. Rook, seek, talk, took, walk, rook, look, spasmodic. She has a structure here that is completely, it's invisible to me the first many, many, many times I read this poem. And yet it's consistent. It's absolutely there. It's there by design.
Wow.
Right?
Same thing is true of the fourth line.
Every single one. First through fifth.
I wouldn't have noticed that if you hadn't started the end.
I have to say that I discovered that in one of these kinds of meetings I never saw it before. And it wasn't a poetry expert who found it either, it just came about. So here we've got something that sounds like she's just sort of rattling it off in a way, and yet it has this hidden structure, this design that's absolutely crafted, meticulously, carefully crafted and put in place.
The theme is exactly the same as in Gerard Manley Hopkins' The Window.
Yeah.
There's, I caught this morning, morning's minion.
Kingdom of the daylight, stuff and dapple, don't
and so on. But the glinting
of the light.
Bird's wing is has that suddenness. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And then he ends up saying no miracle about it. Because mm-hmm. you get the same kind of sudden shine out of the earth that's turned over.
Mm-hmm.
Wow.
We'll be reading that poem later in the week, come back. I've got it in my bathroom poems. I love that poem. Yeah, so is there a miracle or isn't there a miracle is a good question. It's just a very, very normal thing, a black rook in rainy weather put in. We're going to come back to this, like the craftedness of it in a minute. Now I want to ask you this question. How does her angel, the rare random descent, the long wait for the angel, the rare random descent, how does her angel differ from McKeel McBride's angel in Zero Gravity in the poem next to it?
Not common, or the other one is a very common image. This is a very celestial angel
mm-hmm.
she's looking for.
Mm-hmm.
It's still unexpected. You don't expect to see an angel in a repairman, and yet it comes out of very ordinary things, but she's projecting something that just falls like a ray of light through cloud.
Now let's talk about that ordinary versus extraordinary. How extraordinary, in what way is her angel extraordinary? Where does she see her angel?
Well, that isn't really extraordinary because there's some similarity there because the one poet sees an angel in an ordinary thing like a repairman.
Yep.
And there seems to be a sense in the other one that she's longing for something extraordinary, but finding she has to be content with an ordinary thing like mm-hmm. the light shining on a bird, when you might want some real surreal experience, mm-hmm. you have to be content with these small glimpses of light shining.
Yeah.
And so she's
yes.
waiting for a big miracle and finding a certain amount of contentment in smallness.
But the smallness isn't so small. Look what she says.
Radiance, well, it's incandescent.
Yeah.
I mean, it's like a flash.
Yes. Mm-hmm. She says, she would like some back talk from the mute sky. That must be the voice out of the clouds, you know? Mm-hmm.
Become a cook.
but she doesn't get that, but she can't complain because she gets these other things that Justine is talking about. That maybe they're just tricks of radiance, but she gets this flash of light, this celestial burning. And where is it? It's in the rook. Where else?
The kitchen table.
And the kitchen
table
or chair. Okay, now how could you get more homely and common than that? Your kitchen table and chair is even more common than the repairman visiting your home, I hope. So they're both talking about something that's very ordinary, right? And yet these still seem to me to be very different kinds of angelic visitations.
Seems like Sylvia Plath is less trustworthy.
How so?
Well, when your phone breaks, you get a red flannel shirt splitting off the stem, right?
Yeah.
And Sylvia Plath's angel, you don't count on it like that.
That's
she
right.
trudges through fatigue, hoping.
Yeah.
I was very captured yeah. by that brief respite from fear of total neutrality.
Yeah.
Because, you know, it's always said that hate is not the opposite of love, that those two feelings are on a continuum. The opposite of love is apathy.
Yeah.
And if you hit that apathy or that total neutrality, then there's nothing to grab you and hold you here.
Yeah. Yeah.
And this is what grabs her and holds her here. But if she could control it, don't you think that she would grab it herself and keep it with her? But she can't. And she can't really count on it. She can't trust it.
Yeah.
So she just plods and hopes.
She doesn't.
But the other woman loses her phone line and gets a response.
Yeah.
She doesn't trust it. She calls it tricks of radiance, as if it's not a real miracle. And then as soon as it's over, the wait's begun again. So it's not as satisfying as the other.
Well, and also it's kind of interesting.
I'm impressed by the lonesomeness, the loneliness of this.
And how do you contrast that with the other?
Well, you got a real guy in a fine shirt looking like a rose.
That's right. Yeah. Real sense of human connectedness and time.
And with the surprising breaking speech that in revealing something about itself that you didn't expect.
That's right. Where's the community in her wait for the angel? She's so alone. She's got a kitchen table and chair and nobody's in it, you know. Just really isolated.
And it's interesting because she talks about these flashes and yet she talks, I shall patch together a content of sort, which I don't know, is it, you know, content is more calm and quiet than the flash of radiance.
And here's one of those important poetic moments in the poem. How many of you caught this, that I pronounced this content? And what's another pronunciation?
Content.
Content. What's the difference between those two readings? How can she patch? We've talked, your idea that she's patching together content, I think, is very good. That she's sort of sustaining herself in this season of fatigue and neutrality for the next burst of light. And she's going to get together by patching herself together. How do you patch together content? What would that mean?
Meaning. The meaning of sorts.
Yep. Some kind of meaning she might be putting together.
Some sort of way to grab away from the neutrality.
Yeah.
Because neutrality is, again, it's an absence of meaning.
Yeah. Yep. She's got to have that to wait for the angel, because the angel is about meaning in this landscape of emptiness. It's a much less hopeful, you know, the way I read these two poems. I think this woman just met the angel and she's happy, happy, happy. All right. And this one remembers what it's like and is holding on to see that brief flash of radiance again, that moment of spark. But she's in the dry season, right? She's in the waiting time. And they speak in many ways to a similar kind of experience of the divine, but to me they speak at different moments in that sort of sine curve of ecstasy and despair, and she's on the downsweep. And yet the idea that the kitchen table could be so beautiful, even if right now there's no one around her kitchen table, everyone knows that the kitchen table is where the home has its center, right? So that would be so beautiful seems to me hopeful in this poem, but it could just be my ridiculous optimism coming through. I want to read a river poem because I got these two classes together, and I have to say my very favorite river poem in the world is this very, very brief Emily Dickinson poem down here in the corner of your page, which I will now read. Least rivers docile to some sea, my Caspian, thee. Can you paraphrase this by adding a verb? We can play, where's the verb? What's missing? Least rivers docile to some sea. Docile's an adjective.
Flow,
run, where we go.
I am?
Yes. What do you mean?
Like comparison? I am like a...
Right, I am like a river which flows docilely to some sea, and you are
my
Caspian. Now, does anyone know anything about the Caspian Sea? I only know this because Luther wrote a paper on it in his English class at Harvard. But the Caspian turns out to be, is it the largest inland sea?
Landlocked.
Landlocked, totally the largest land sea. You know, we don't need people's papers. Something
geography.
Yeah.
Geography, very good.
Salt.
It's the largest, it's a salt sea, but it is the largest landlocked sea. What does it mean to say, well, let's start with the first line. The least rivers, meaning what's least here? The smallest rivers run docilely to some sea. What does that statement suggest?
We're all part of something bigger.
That's right, that's good. We're all part of something bigger. The smallest rivers still join a sea.
She always thought of stuff in that way too. Small, least,
that's
little,
right.
Out of the way. Those are always her comparisons to herself.
Mm-hmm. When she gets in contact with a bigger thing, it changes. She changes.
Yes,
her
yes.
Her melds or mixes and, mm-hmm. and everything has changed. I mean, the big Caspian Sea has changed, you know, less salty when all the little creeks run into it.
Right, that's good.
Most of the words, there's things running into it, but nothing running out or nothing coming back.
Yeah, maybe it can hold it all.
I think it's interesting. She chooses something that a lot of other rivers flow into as well,
mm-hmm.
besides just herself.
That's right. Mm-hmm. Now, if you are my Caspian, who are you? Do you think in this poem?
Well, D is capitalized.
Yeah, I hope I did that right, by the way. I couldn't find it in my selected Emily Dickinson, so I just had to make it up. But. He is capitalized, in which case it might, she had, if you know Emily Dickinson, rather funny ideas about capitalization anyhow, but what do you think a capital V might be?
God.
Be thou, him, her? Could be God. So if God is like the sea and she's like the smallest river.
Docile.
Docile. Yeah. Docile.
Without reason.
Not raging.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and it doesn't imply any resistance.
Yeah, right. It's a peaceful kind of joining, isn't it?
But why the Caspian?
Yeah, because it's dead. Most salt water places have very little life.
Mm-hmm.
Why would you pick that?
Yeah, why not pick the Atlantic or some nice, big, powerful, living ocean?
Mediterranean.
Well, it's also very remote, and in her day, I would suspect not very well known.
Yeah, that could very well be.
I wonder if it is. But in ancient times, there's a lot of mythology. And the journey of the Argo went through the Caspian.
Went through the Caspian, is that it?
No.
Didn't
it?
Black Sea.
The Black Sea. They went into the Black Sea.
Oh.
Hmm. There might be a mythological reference, though. I just think she kind of likes the sound of it. Although there might be the fact that it's inland, you know, that it's protected, and she's the smallest river, and she's entering a protected sea, so that sense of being enclosed might be important to her. Emily Dickinson often writes poems that could be love poems or could be hymns of praise, and they almost sort of shift back and forth even as you look at them. So she could be talking about joining with the Godhead, or she could be talking about joining with one of her, we think, probably imaginary lovers. And the poem seems to me to work beautifully either way that way. I'd like to end with just reading the poem plain. And I have a little, I don't really have any time at all, but if you'll permit me, I'll read one of my favorite poems by Robert Bly, an older poem. He's not really one of my favorite poets, but I just love this poem. I really love it. And it is a powerful visual poem that should give you a strong sense of image. And I have recently learned, this will be good for Harland, that they don't say Milan.
Milan.
They say Milan. So when you hear me pronouncing this town in Minnesota, which is close to where Harland grew up, you will hear me pronouncing it the correct way. How about the Lac-qui Parle River? Is that about right? Lac-qui Parle, Lac-qui Parle. Could that be the lake which speaks?
Yeah.
Oh, so I never thought of that. Okay. I am driving, it is dusk, Minnesota. The stubble field catches the last growth of sun. The soybeans are breathing on all sides. Old men are sitting before their houses on car seats in the small towns. I am happy, the moon rising about the turkey sheds. The small world of the car plunges through the deep fields of the night on the road from Wilmer to Milan. This solitude covered with iron moves through the fields of night, penetrated by the noise of crickets. Nearly to Milan, suddenly a small bridge and water kneeling in the moonlight. In small towns, the houses are built right on the ground. The lamplight falls on all fours in the grass. When I reach the river, the full moon covers it. A few people are talking low in a boat. Now, you may, if you ever have a chance to talk with anyone about this, ask them, do they feel melancholy, exhilarated, bored? How they feel as they receive these images, because I have found that there is a wide variation in what people think the emotional thrust of the poem is.
What's the name of that poem?
Driving Toward the La Quiparo River. Well, thank you all very much. That was a lot of fun.
Thursday.
The next one will be Thursday.